that, I think it's important that we move forward on allowing the opportunity, because if they work, why would we be opposed to that?
A controversial proposal to bring down the high rate of crime in rural Alaska. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, the 11th of August. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a behind-the-scenes look at John McCain's choice of Sarah Palin as a running mate.
Very few people in the campaign knew that she was truly in the mix. That was very, very closely held.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Alaska Communication Systems, converging voice, video, internet, and data applications for business. ACS connects companies from the North Slope to Ketchikan to each other and the rest of the world.
The early signs are that Alaska's tribal governments are going to get a significant boost from the Obama administration cabinet members visiting this week. Housing and Urban Development Secretary Sean Donovan announced some big block grant awards to tribes from the federal stimulus bill on the public radio call-in show Talk of Alaska today.
In fact, this is the largest competitive award that we've ever made in the history of HUD that we're announcing today, over $130 million nationwide. In total, what that means is that the tribes in Alaska will get about $40 million in formula funding out of the Recovery Act. And with the announcement today, you're talking about almost a similar amount, close to $40 million in competitive funding that will be available to the tribe. So they did very, very well in this competition.
The Association of Village Council Presidents Regional Housing Authority in Bethel won a $5 million grant in the latest round, and grants of $2 million housing dollars will go to tribes in Mountain Village, Ketchikan, Metlakatla, and Arctic Village. The grants can be used to build or rehabilitate housing. There are also grants for roads, water and sewer facilities, and other infrastructure. A high priority was put on projects that could get started quickly. Donovan says the Alaska tribes had a higher success rate than other states' tribes.
Whereas about one-third of all applications were successful in our competition in Alaska, it was two-thirds.
The secretary said that pattern is also seen in the overall distribution of HUD stimulus grants. Bethel is preparing for a visit from four Obama administration cabinet secretaries tomorrow. The delegation includes HUD Secretary Donovan, Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack, Education Secretary Arne Duncan, and Energy Secretary Stephen Chu. They're stopping in Bethel and Hooper Bay as part of a rural tour of America. Angela Denning Barnes has been following the action leading up to the event in Bethel. She says the advanced planning group from Washington, D.C. has been in town for almost a week.
They're coming from the different departments, and they each have an advanced planning director. And so they've kind of been living here in Bethel for the past week, checking things out and making sure things are going to go well.
And what about security? What special security is in place?
They're trying to make sure, from what I understand, they're trying to make sure that the secretaries are pretty insulated from the general public, especially like during transit, except for the special events that are happening on their agenda when they're scheduled, you know, to meet with the public. So they don't want people around them, you know, as they're coming and going from buildings. They have set up that they, you know, want the secretaries to have a private entrance into the cultural center and, you know, have some private welcome meetings and that kind of thing, and pretty much stick to the agenda as to, you know, when the public will have a chance to actually see them and then talk to them.
And Angela, what's the buzz around town? How are people feeling about this visit?
I think people are pretty excited. They're very excited for this opportunity to, you know, not only see all these secretaries locally here in their town at the same time, you know, and then all the hoopla that goes with that, but they're excited to, you know, have the chance to actually, even if it's just for 1 minute or 2 minutes during this town hall meeting, to have their own voice heard. That's kind of an opportunity of a lifetime, I think. And I think some people are really taking that seriously, and they're preparing and trying to get ready what they might say, you know, in that short little time slot.
Angela, do you think the cabinet secretaries can really get a sense of life in rural Alaska in such a short time?
Well, that's a really good question, and that's kind of the lingering question for me. I know they've been traveling around the country already on this rural listening tour, but Alaska is so very different from other parts of the country. And then certainly rural Alaska is different than any place else. So I think One thing that they definitely have going for them is this trip to Hooper Bay. You know, 3 hours in the village will be a great thing for them to experience, because Bethel itself is a town of 6,000. It's a hub. It's a regional hub. And for a lot of residents out here, you know, most people live in the village. So, you know, I think it'll be great for them to see these new structures like the new wind turbines and the new housing units and the new clinic, you know, so they could see that their funding is in fact being used well and these structures are really helping the community out. But at the same time, I hope that they have a chance to just visit and hear from the everyday people, the local folk, about how they're living day to day. And, you know, if they can squeeze that all into 3 hours, then I think they'll be the better for it.
You've lived in Bethel a long time. Does this compare to any other event you've seen there before?
No, not at all. I mean, in my 10 years here, we've had secretaries. We've had U.S. secretaries visit Bethel. But this is kind of totally on a different level. And, you know, it'll be a great experience just to see how it all pans out.
Angela Denning Barnes is the news director for KYUK in Bethel. Draft legislation called the Tribal Law and Order Act is expected to be on the agenda for lawmakers after their summer recess. The act seeks to address violent crime in Native communities. A proposed amendment to the act would create a pilot project in Alaska that would give up to 5 tribal communities that have tribal courts more authority in dealing with domestic violence, alcohol, and drug crimes. The state strongly opposes the idea because Alaska doesn't have the same reservation system or Indian country status as the lower 48. The lines of legal and governmental jurisdiction for tribes here aren't as clearly defined. Earlier this year, then-acting Attorney General Rick Svobodny wrote the 9-page letter saying the act could result in years of litigation. But Native American Rights Fund attorney Heather Kendall Miller says people are being hurt, children are being neglected, and the state has no presence in many of these communities. She says it's time to take a new direction to address the high rates of crime.
There has to come a point when people put aside the ideology of states' rights versus tribal rights or sovereignty, state sovereignty versus tribal sovereignty, and try to figure out what works best for the people involved. And that's what this demonstration project attempts to do.
The proposal stems from work conducted by the Rural Justice Commission that was created by Congress in 2004 to look at law enforcement in rural Alaska. Kendall Miller says the scope of the proposal for Alaska is very narrow and should not threaten the state.
It is not a broad grant or delegation of authority to exercise jurisdiction in any other area. It's a very limited grant. The details or specifics of language have already been offered in a way that is actually quite narrow and does not suggest that these tribes are going to have general Indian country jurisdiction, but very specific jurisdiction over alcohol, domestic abuse, and drugs.
Svobodny declined to comment on the proposal, saying it would not be appropriate until the state has a chance to meet with tribal leaders in an effort to find language that the state is comfortable with. When Senator Mark Begich was Anchorage mayor, he was an enthusiastic supporter of youth and wellness courts, which he says are modeled after tribal courts. He says it's past time to deal with these long-standing rural crime problems.
We have to be focused on innovative and different approaches and how to deal with the criminal justice system, especially in rural communities where states have, especially the state of Alaska, has limited resources and does not have the highest focus. And even though they'll claim today they're working on it, that's what they've been claiming since the day I was on the Anchorage Assembly in 1988.
Begich says if the state can arrange meetings with tribes and they can agree on language, he'd be happy to look at it.
But I think it's important that we move forward on allowing the opportunity and creating the opportunity for the state tribal communities to tap into this resource to do demonstration projects. Because if they work, why would we be opposed to that? You know, because it's, you know, upwards to almost 67% of the folks are reoffending now, and the state court system doesn't tell me that's the most effective approach.
Alaska Federation of Natives General Counsel Donna Goldsmith says AFN is also hoping for new ways to help Native communities be safer places to live.
AFN supports
in principle, an Alaska-specific amendment that would address the public safety needs of the women and children and families living in rural Alaska villages. But there isn't specific language that we're focused on at this point.
The Tribal Law and Order Act was introduced by North Dakota Democrat Senator Byron Dorgan, who chairs the Indian Affairs Committee, along with Senator Lisa Murkowski, who is also a co-sponsor of the bill. It aims to amend the Indian Tribal Justice Act and a host of others, attempting to clarify the complex jurisdictional crossover between state, federal, and tribal law. Murkowski's staff report they will continue consultation with tribes on rural Alaska law enforcement issues over the August recess and won't comment further until after that process. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a bad season for wasps in Fairbanks.
I've had other people call in to say that they're trying to pick their raspberries and the yellow jackets are actually chasing them.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. A fisheries degree prepares you for a career in fisheries biology, management, business or policy, and more. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
Alaska's inmates currently in a private prison in the lower 48 will be a little closer to the state by the end of the year. The Department of Corrections has decided to move prisoners from a leased facility in Arizona to a newly constructed facility it's leasing in Colorado. The department's Deputy Commissioner for Operations, Sam Edwards, says the new prison, owned by the Texas-based Cornell Companies, will save the state between $4 to $6 a day for each of the approximately 800 men lodged there. But Edwards says the department had an even more important reason to go to the Colorado facility.
We wanted, if we could, to be either the sole contractor in an institution or at least the primary. And the reason for that is less shared resources, whether it's recreation or program space or staff time, all that. That was a consideration for us.
The Hudson, Colorado prison has total housing for 1,250 inmates, and Alaska has guaranteed payment for at least 800 and possibly as many as 1,000 men for the next 3 years until the Goose Creek Correctional Center opens in the Mat-Su area. The total cost will be about $22 million per year. Edwards says the Cornell contract will keep the same services in place now, but will have more emphasis on preparing people for re-entry into society when they complete their sentences. The Hudson prison is still under construction, but the company says it plans to finish work during the next 3 months. Edwards says the department has not confirmed any transportation plans yet.
What we're looking at, a tentative time period, is that we would begin moving toward the end of November, and we would hope to be completely moved before Christmas.
Edwards said the state had a big response from prison owners when the project went out for bid. The Juneau School Board is wrestling with a plan to institute mandatory random drug testing for high school students in athletics. A task force started its work in June after more than 1,200 concerned Juneau parents, coaches, citizens, and students presented a petition to the board calling for the testing. The task force report covers mostly illegal drugs, but Juneau police say the time-released prescription painkiller OxyContin has become the drug of choice in the southeast city. Police and prosecutors believe most of it is obtained illegally. Rebecca Shear has more on the illicit ways OC makes its way to the capital city.
Our story begins at a pharmacy where one can legally buy OxyContin with a doctor's prescription.
So this is a 10 milligram OxyContin bottle of 100. And they typically come to us as pharmacies in bottles of 100.
Scott Watts is a registered pharmacist with Ron's Apothecary Shop. Even though Ron's Apothecary supplies Oxy,
we say 1 to 2 prescriptions a day.
Watts says a growing number of pharmacies don't.
Pharmacies will have a sign out that says, "We do not carry this medication."
Watts suspects they fear illegal or forged Oxy prescriptions.
Or just having OxyContin in the store might make it more susceptible to burglaries of some sorts.
In fact, Ron's was burglarized in December 2003. When thieves broke in through the ceiling and stole a bunch of 10, 20, and 40 milligram tablets of the habit-forming narcotic. OxyContin's active ingredient, oxycodone, can be as addictive as morphine. Juneau police also have caught people breaking into houses to steal Oxy tablets and prescriptions. But Narcotics Unit Supervisor Sergeant David Campbell says the number of thefts is relatively small.
In talking to some of the people that we have recently arrested, I know that people are consuming, you know, multiple pills a day in order to feed their addiction.
So given the quantities people need to sustain their high, Campbell believes illegal importation is primarily to blame for Juneau's Oxy problem.
Whether it's through an airline carrier, the ferry, a mail carrier, a moving company, any way that you can get something to Juneau is a mechanism for somebody to get illegal drugs, be it OxyContin or any other type of controlled substance.
JPD in November partnered with the State Trooper Task Force CCAD, that's Southeast Alaska Cities Against Drugs, to intercept parcels at FedEx, UPS, and the U.S. Post Office in Juneau. That month, they actually seized 95 Oxy tablets headed out of the capital city, bound for Ketchikan. Estimated street value? $17,000.
A pill that may sell for $40 down in Seattle may sell for $140 here. So there is a huge economic incentive to bring the oxycodone into a very tight and isolated market.
Juneau District Attorney Doug Gardner says the prescription painkiller hit Juneau in 2005 and has become the city's most serious and fastest growing drug problem.
OxyContin is probably involved in at least 50% of the felony cases right now.
Possession of Oxy is a Class C felony.
And so somebody could be in a sentencing range of 0 to 5 years, depending on their criminal history.
And dealing the stuff,
which is another huge problem in Juneau right now,
is a Class A felony.
And a person involved in that can be looking at anywhere between 5 to 8 years.
But Gardner says even with the threat of a lengthy prison sentence, people are still illicitly bringing OxyContin to Juneau.
You could put a bag of 1,000 of them in less than a shoebox, secrete them into an airplane, luggage, ferry, and sell them for a huge profit.
Gardner says he'd like to see JPD team with Seattle Airport Police, Alaska State Troopers, and law enforcement throughout Southeast Alaska to fight the illegal importation of Oxy. In the meantime, in terms of what Junoites can do on the home front,
locking your home, and if you have a prescription for OxyContin, maintaining that in a place where it's safe would help deal with some of the problem.
Back at Ron's apothecary shop, Scott Watts agrees.
Speaking for all pharmacists in town, we don't want to be part of the issue of it going to anywhere it should not be going. So we counsel everybody to keep these hidden out of sight. I mean, nobody else needs to know you have it.
Watts says he's seen the number of Oxy prescriptions drop in the last few years as doctors and insurance companies have wised up to the abuse problem.
It's a very, very, very dangerous drug if taken incorrectly or by the wrong people. So, yeah, it can affect and ruin a lot of lives. It's hard to believe a little tablet like that can do that much, but unless it's strictly prescribed for you for long-term pain, stay away from it, please.
The OxyContin Reward Program offers $500 to $1,500 for information leading to the arrest of anyone purchasing or distributing the prescription drug. In Juneau, I'm Rebecca Shear.
There is an alarming increase in the rate of two sexually transmitted diseases in the YK Delta. Both chlamydia and gonorrhea have increased dramatically in the region since 2007. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Alice Criswell reports.
In 2008, the rate of gonorrhea for the whole state of Alaska was 85 cases per 100,000. That rate hasn't changed very much in the past 5 years. That is, except for Southwest Alaska, where it rose by 100 cases from 2007 to 2008. Donna Cicere is the STD coordinator for State Health Department.
In southwestern Alaska, the gonorrhea infection rate was 373 cases per 100,000 persons, and that was an increase over the 2007 rate of 118 cases per 100,000 persons.
The gonorrhea disease most often affects people between 15 and 30 years old. Cicere says they are just starting to investigate what might be causing an increase in gonorrhea cases in the region. Meanwhile, Cicere says chlamydia has long been a problem for the region.
The Bethel-Wade-Hampton area has had high rates of chlamydia, and over the years it's been, you know, quite a bit higher than just the statewide average.
Chlamydia is often called the silent disease because so many people don't know they have it and can keep spreading it around. In Bethel, I'm Alice Criswell.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Working late? Hear Alaska News Nightly at any time of the day on the web at www.aprn.org.
Yellow jacket wasps are bugging people in Fairbanks again. University of Alaska Fairbanks pest management specialist Diane Clausen says this summer's hot, dry conditions are conducive to wasp survival, and she's been getting calls about them causing problems around homes and gardens.
Congregating around decks, around lawns. A couple of people have actually had wasps that have built ground nests in their raised beds that they're growing vegetables in. I've had other people call in to say that they're trying to pick their raspberries and the yellow jackets are actually chasing them.
Yellow jacket numbers were extremely high in the Fairbanks area in 2006. Many people were stung and two died from allergic reactions. University of Alaska insect curator Derek Sykes says there's no hard data on yellow jackets, but that it appears their population has ramped up again.
After the big outbreak in 2006, there's a great concern that 2007 would have a similar large numbers, but they didn't. In fact, 2007, there was a real crash, where there were hardly any nests reported, and 2008 was certainly lower numbers than we're seeing this year. So this year is, I'm guessing, we're getting back to normal.
There are 11 species of yellow jackets in the interior, and Sykes says the common variety is the one most likely to bother people.
The one that nests in the ground and in logs and under outbuildings and has these hidden nests. And it's also a scavenger, in addition to being a predator. So it's the one most likely to come after your food, really be much more of a pest.
Sykes says common yellow jackets are important for pollination and eating other bugs. Washington Post political reporter Dan Baltz doesn't pretend to know where Sarah Palin's career is heading, but in his new book, The Battle for America 2008, he gives new insight into her meteoric rise on the national stage last summer. With co-author Haynes Johnson, he describes how she was picked as John McCain's running mate, electrified the presidential race, but ultimately hurt his candidacy. Baltz says McCain decided to make Palin his running mate because he realized he needed to do something dramatic to win the election.
They had seen what had happened in the late summer. They feared that Obama would be able to use his convention almost to gain an insurmountable lead. And in that week before they made the pick of Sarah Palin, they were searching around for a way to do something that would, in many ways, solve a whole series of problems. And they turned to Sarah Palin to help solve those problems.
How much resistance, or what was there resistance to choosing her among his advisors?
Well, the truth is very few people in the campaign knew that she was truly in the mix. That was very, very closely held. There were only probably four or five people who really knew what was going on. So among the people who knew about Palin, several were very much in favor of her doing it. Steve Schmidt, who was the senior advisor and the day-to-day manager of the campaign, was drawn to her, as was Rick Davis, who was the campaign manager. Mark Salter, who was a confidant, very, very close to McCain, I think was skeptical about it. I think he felt that Tim Pawlenty, the governor of Minnesota, was a sounder choice, that Sarah Palin certainly was a risky choice. But even Mark Salter, because of his loyalty to Senator McCain, I don't think sort of threw his body in front of the train as it was heading down that track.
Palin seemed very confident during her nomination and acceptance speech at the Republican convention for McCain's campaign. What are your thoughts about her presentation and the reaction from the crowd?
Well, it was one of the high moments of the convention. When she gave that speech and I was in the hall that night, you could tell that she had really, really done well. Certainly, it excited the convention. She reinvigorated the base of the Republican Party. And coming out of the convention, I think people were looking at that choice as perhaps McCain has actually pulled off something here that's going to pay some dividends. I mean, the crowds that they generated, the amount of money that was coming in, I mean, everything was, you know, pointing upward for the campaign. And that, in fact, lasted for the better part of 2 weeks.
Palin's speeches out on the campaign trail contain some very inflammatory rhetoric about Obama palling around with terrorists, comes to mind. How involved was she with writing these particular segments, and was she reluctant or enthusiastic about saying such things?
Well, it's one of the interesting things that we discovered in the book, because there had been some sense that in one way or another, she had decided to go after Obama for his past relationship with Bill Ayers, the 60s radical. And as it turned out, there was a New York Times article on the morning of October 4th, which was a lengthy article reexamining the relationship between Obama and Ayers. And it was that morning that Palin's traveling entourage received an email from the McCain headquarters essentially saying, we would like you to insert the following into your speech. And it was a short but very pithy script going after Obama over Ayers, and in fact using the phrase pals around with terrorists. Now, when she got this assignment that morning, she was more than enthusiastic about it. She sent back an email that, if I can recall it verbatim, said something to the effect of, yes, 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 please let me say this. And after she had delivered it, she sent back another email saying it was awesome. So it was something that she was certainly prepared to do, but in this case, it was well scripted from the McCain campaign and not something that she and a couple of people traveling with her cooked up on their own.
Mr. Baltz, when did things start to go wrong for Sarah Palin and the campaign?
They started to go wrong for Sarah Palin, I think, most significantly when she did the interviews with Katie Couric from CBS. She handled it very badly. Everybody in the campaign knew it. Some of the questions were not that difficult. She knew she had done badly. She was not happy with that performance, but she was also not happy with her staff. And I think it is literally from that day forward that you could see the trajectory of her candidacy begin to go down, and it continued to go down through the course of the campaign. In the end, Lori, I don't think that Sarah Palin cost John McCain the election. I think that was factors other than simply Sarah Palin's performance. But there's no question that Sarah Palin hurt herself, and probably in doing so, hurt the overall ticket as well.
Dan Baltz is co-author of The Battle for America 2008. He's the lead political reporter for The Washington Post. For a longer version of the interview, including a look at what McCain staffers thought of Palin, go to APRN.org. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Angela Denning Barnes and Alice Criswell in Bethel, Rebecca Sheeran Juneau, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau and Steve Heimel from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Andy Feit. Our audio engineer is Gooseberry Peter. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by First National Bank Alaska, working shoulder to shoulder with Alaskan businesses for nearly a century. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.